The White Guard by Mikhail Bulgakov. It began to snow, lightly at first, but then in large flakes. The wind started to howl. It was a snowstorm. In an instant, the dark sky merged into an ocean of snow. Everything disappeared.
"We're done for now, sir," shouted the coachman. "It's a blizzard."
Pushkin, the captain's daughter. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. Book of Revelation, chapter 20, verse 12. Part 1. Chapter 1. Great and terrible was the year of our Lord 1918, the second year after the revolution. The summer was abundant with sun, and the winter with snow, and two stars stood especially high in the sky, the shepherd's star, the evening Venus, and red, quivering Mars. Yet, whether times are peaceful or bloody, the days fly past like arrows, and the young Turbins did not notice the onset of white, hoary December. Oh, Santa Claus, glistening with snow and happiness! Oh, mother of ours, glittering queen, where are you? A year after her daughter Yelena had married Captain Sergei Ivanovich Talberg, and in the very same week in which her elder son, Alexei Vasilievich Turbin, had returned home to the Ukraine, to the city, after a disastrous period of military service and heavy fighting, that very same week, the white coffin containing the body of their mother had been carried down the steep St. Alexei's Hill to the little church of St. Nicholas the Good in Podol, on the embankment. It was May when they conducted the funeral service for their mother, and the arched windows of the church were overhung with the branches of cherry trees and acacias. Father Alexander, stumbling from grief and strong emotion, sparkled and shone in the golden lights, and the deacon, his face and neck the color of violet, the forged gold gleaming from his head right down to the soles of his boots, sorrowfully intoned the words of the funeral service for a mother who had left her children behind. Alexei, Yelena, Talberg, Anyuta, who had been brought up as one of the family, and young Nikolka, stunned by the death, with a lock of hair falling over his right eyebrow, stood at the foot of the ancient brown icon of St. Nicholas. Nikolka's light blue eyes, on either side of his long, bird-like nose, wore a lost, shattered expression. From time to time he looked up at the iconostasis, at the arch of the altar, barely perceptible in the semi-gloom, and at the sad, enigmatic figure of an ancient god, towering above them and winking. Why had this insult been inflicted upon them? What an injustice! Why had it been necessary to take their mother away from them, just when everyone had come together and started to feel a sense of relief? Flying away into the crack in the dark sky, God said nothing in reply, and Nikolka was as yet unaware that everything that happens, whatever it might be, is always as it should be, and always only for the best. When the service was over, they went out onto the ringing flagstones of the church porch and accompanied their mother the whole way across the huge city to the cemetery, where their father had long since lain under a black marble cross, and there they buried their mother. How many years before their mother's death at number 13 on St. Alexei's Hill had little Yelena, the elder son Alexei, and tiny Nikolka been warmed and nurtured by the tiled stove in the dining room? How often had they sat by its glowing tiles, reading The Shipwright of Saddam, with the clock playing its gavotte? At the end of every December, the air had been filled with the scent of pine needles, the multicolored paraffin candles glowing on the green branches. The black clock on the dining room wall had chimed in response to the gavotte played by the bronze clock standing in their mother's, now Yelena's, bedroom. Their father had bought these clocks long ago, when women still wore comical sleeves puffed up to the shoulders. These sleeves had disappeared. Time had sped by. Their professor father had died. Everyone had grown up. But the clocks remained, continuing to chime just as they had always done. These clocks had become so familiar that if by some strange chance they had vanished from the walls, Everybody would have been affected as much as if a familiar voice had died, creating a gap that nothing could fill. But clocks, fortunately, live forever, just as the shipwright of Saardam lives forever, and, like some wise ancient rock, the tiled Dutch stove continued, even in the most difficult times, to radiate warmth and life. And these tiles, together with the old red velvet furniture, the beds with their shiny brass knobs, the worn rugs, some multicolored, some red, depicting Alexei Mikhailovich with a falcon perched on his arm, the portrait of Louis XIV reclining languorously on the shores of a silken lake in some heavenly garden, the Turkish carpets with their stunning oriental curlicues that entered the young Nikolka's delirious dreams when in bed with scarlet fever, the bronze lamp and lampshade, the finest bookshelves in the world, smelling mysteriously of old chocolate, with Natasha Rostova and the captain's daughter, the gilt cups, the silver, the portraits and the drapes, all seven dusty, cluttered rooms that had nurtured the young Turbins. All this the children had inherited from their mother at the most difficult of times. With her final breaths, she had clutched at the weeping Yelena's hand and enjoined them all to live together in friendship. But exactly how were they to live? How? The elder brother, the young Dr. Alexei Vasilievich Turbin, was 28, Yelena, 24, her husband, Captain Talberg, 31, and Nikolka, 17 and a half. Their lives seemed to have been shattered just as dawn was breaking. The winds had long since started to blow from the north, to blow and blow without ceasing, and the more they blew, the worse it all became. The oldest Turbin had returned to his native city after the first gusts had blasted the hills above the river Dnieper. Now, at last, one might have thought, it would all stop, and the way of life depicted in those books smelling of chocolate would begin. But instead, it simply grew more and more terrible. The blizzard in the north howled and howled, while, close at hand, they could hear the dull rumbling of thunder and an anguished growling from the depths of the earth. As the year 1918 flew towards its end, life became more threatening and bristling with the passing of each day. The walls would fall, the frightened falcon would fly from the Tsar's white sleeve, the light in the bronze lamp would fade, and the captain's daughter would be burnt in the stove. And although the mother had told her children to live, the time would surely come when they would suffer and die. One day, at dusk, shortly after their mother's funeral, Alexei Turbin went to Father Alexander and said, "We're all feeling so sad, Father Alexander. It's hard for us to forget about our mother, especially when times are so difficult. After all, I've only just got back from the fighting, and I thought we could put everything right. And now this." He fell silent. Sitting at the table in the twilight, he looked pensively into the distance. The priest's little house was overhung with branches from the trees in the church courtyard, so that the walls of the cramped, book-lined study seemed to mark the edge of a mysterious, tangled spring forest. Filled with the scent of lilac, the evening air hummed with the muffled sound of the city.
"What can you do?"
the priest muttered a couple of times. He was always embarrassed whenever he had to talk to anyone.
"It's the will of God."
"Do you think that perhaps all this will come to an end? That maybe things will be better in the future?" Turbin asked, addressing no one in particular. The priest shifted uneasily in his chair.
"Times are unquestionably hard," he muttered, "but you must not be downhearted."
Then, suddenly, freeing his pale white hand from the dark sleeve of his cassock, he placed it on a pile of books and opened the top book at the page in which there was already a colored, embroidered bookmark.
"Despair must not be permitted," he said, still sounding embarrassed, but now with a note of conviction in his voice. "It is a great sin. Even though there will be trials and tribulations to come, I think. Yes, yes, major trials and tribulations," he said, speaking in an even more assured tone. "Lately, you know, I have been sitting at my books, mostly theological, of course."
Raising the book a little to allow the last rays of light from the window to fall upon the page, he started to read.
"And the third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of waters. and they became blood.